and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am here today with colleagues to talk about the very contentious trade situation between the U.S. and Canada and what that might mean for the European Union. My guests today are Phil Luck from CSIS. We have two of my Bruegel colleagues, Ignacio Garcia Becerro and Jacob Funk Kierkegaard, both from Bruegel. We are going to be talking about the past, present, and future of the transatlantic trade relationship and what it means that the U.S., which not so long ago had a trade deal with Canada and Mexico, now is blowing up even the trade arrangements it has made during the Trump administration's second term, and what that's going to mean for all of us going forward. Phil, what has just happened and how weird is this?
How weird is this? I feel like it's a constantly evolving scale. Pretty weird. And first of all, thank you so much for having me. Really excited to be on the program today. The United States, where I'm based, has a lot of free trade agreements around the world. Of course, notably the USMCA, which was negotiated in Trump's first term, is one of the largest and one of the most expansive free trade agreements in the world, and you know, since the early 90s. And our free trade agreement with Canada has started in 1989, so we're going on quite a long time. We have been going through renegotiations of this agreement over the past year. As always with free trade agreements, there are sticking points that cause irritants. And with Canada, it's softwood lumber and dairy and all sorts of fun stuff like that. But also, in the early days of the Trump administration, Canada is one of the only countries to actually retaliate against the United States. Basically, it was largely Canada and China. And it has never sat well with the Trump administration that Canada actually retaliated. And in addition to that, at the provincial level, several provinces took American spirits off the shelves and things like that. So in an effort to try to get Canada to back down from some of that retaliation, the Trump administration used Section 338, a Smoot-Hawley 1930s era trade law, which had never been used before, specifically for situations where countries retaliate or use trade policy to sort of punish a partner, which, you know, is exactly what Canada is doing. They didn't start it, but they certainly were retaliating. So this was an effort to get Canada to back down. It was about $20 billion worth of tariffs. Ongoing negotiations. You can decide who you trust on this. Both sides sort of blame the other for why they broke down, but they broke down and Canada decided to impose its own tariffs dollar for dollar matching the United States. So we're in a bit of a stalemate right now where both sides are digging in and not looking to compromise. But basically, we have tariffs between the United States and Canada that are highest they've been since at least the 1970s. So it's not going well.
Ignacio, you have held trade talks with Canada and with the U.S. during your prior career with the European Commission. How did this look to you?
Well, let me talk a little bit further on what I think is behind this trade war between United States and Canada. I'm happy later on if you want to look a little bit more on issues like implications for the European Union. In my view, you really, to try to understand what is happening, you need to look into the core of the economic conflict. You need to look into the retaliation, and then you need to look into the politics of the conflict. Now, the core of the conflict, I think, is very clear. Canada renegotiated with the United States NAFTA in the first Trump administration. A fundamental objective was to secure the free trade in some sectors which are very important for the Canada, like steel, aluminium, cars, and trucks. And the Trump II administration decided to ignore the USMCA, despite the fact that they had actually renegotiated the agreement, had applied very, very high tariffs on all countries, including Canada, on particularly these sectors, the steel, aluminium, car and trust. And of course, Canada, that was more impacted than any country, decided to retaliate. By the way, the European Union had retaliated against steel in Trump 1. It decided not to retaliate on steel in Trump 2. And then we can talk about the reasons for that. So the core, I think, of the economic conflict is on the one hand, the treatment of Canadian steel cars and truck in the United States. And of all the different retaliatory measures, the one that is more impactful is the one that has been adopted not by the federal government, but by provinces, and particularly some provinces like Ontario, and that is the ban on the sale of U.S. alcohol in Canada. But I said, it depends on the province. It's not the same in all provinces. So that, I think, is the core of the economic conflict. And the reason, fundamental reason why the tariff broke down was because the United States was not ready to offer enough to satisfy the concerns of Canada, particularly when it came to the issue of staff. Then there's the new retaliation, which Philip has mentioned, coming from this law that was from the days of Helmut Holly and had never been used by the United States, Section 338. I think this retaliation, quite frankly, both from the U.S. side and from the Canadian side, is rather small. We're basically talking about something like $20 billion of trade, subject to 50% tariff. I think, in my view, this is not as significant as the core of the economic problem, which is the one which I referred to before. What would be the impact of all of this? Let's see how the situation evolves between now and 1st of January, when the U.S. has threatened a much more significant retaliation. But I think that the new retaliation in itself is not very economically significant. And then is the politics. I mean, the politics is that this U.S. administration has been decided to question the sovereignty of Canada almost from the very beginning, questioning the independence of Canada as a state. And within that very charged political context, you come to a negotiation, and apparently, although no one knows exactly what was requested by the United States, but apparently you put on the table limitations on the right of Canada to conclude trade agreement with third countries. I mean, it's very clear that Canada would never have kept to that. And I was listening recently to Mark Carney saying that there are certain requests that Canada would never be ready to accept. I think, in my view, these are the three dimensions as I see it. A very significant economic conflict about steel, cars, and alcohol. Some symbolic new retaliation to be input into the zone, into the blue. And a very complex political context in which it's going to be difficult to reach an agreement because of the perception that what is being put on that in question is the sovereignty of Canada by the United States.
Thank you. Jacob, what's the global context here? The Trump administration is starting shooting wars in Iran and, depending on how you look at it, Venezuela, and now it's doing trade wars or coming back to trade wars. What is this doing to our geopolitical situation?
I think it shows a number of things. I think, first of all, I think it shows that Donald Trump doesn't really care about the midterms. I think you have seen that in the way he has refused to end the war in Iran, obviously. But to start a major, and I mean, while I agree with what Ignacio says, this is not an all-out trade war, but it is still a pretty significant one. With your neighboring country, a couple of months before a midterm election where your party is not polling very well, and you've got at least three Senate races that are toss-up, that are bordering Canada. You got Maine, Michigan, and Alaska. Basically putting trade with these states, which with a target on its back, because the Canadian retaliation that comes into force on, I think, September 8th is going to focus on that. So while there's no doubt that Canada is the economically smaller party here and therefore is likely to suffer economically the most, I don't think there's any doubt that Mark Carney has politically decided that it was preferential for him to pick this war, a trade war, at this point in time, right before the U.S. elections, in the hope that maybe he helps push, either Maine or either of these three Senate seats into the hands of the Democrats. We will see whether that political calculus plays out. But I think, you mentioned Venezuela, and there has been, as Ignacio also mentioned, a lot of talk by the president in his second term about the 51st state and about how Canada should be grateful for all the stuff that it gets from the United States, etc. And this is obviously a major irritant. It's one of the reasons why I think Mark Carney is the most popular prime minister in Canadian history. It's because he has been able to articulate a coherent stance in opposition to Donald Trump, which is also why I think Donald Trump has come back to this retaliation, because he's gotten under his skin. And yesterday we heard the former Canadian foreign minister say, in reference to the recent, what should we call it, colonialist or corrupt or whatever you want to call the oil deal that the Trump administration, through some interlocutors, have struck with the current leadership in Venezuela as something that Canada looks at and clearly decides will never happen, that they can never allow to happen in Canada. I mean, it's quite a striking, I think, political statement to basically link this almost with, you know, what the Trump administration is now doing to Canada, to the broader reinstatement of, you know, something that looks like the Monroe or Donroe or whatever we choose to call it, this assertion of essentially U.S. political, at least, and economic supremacy over a large part of the Western Hemisphere. So what does that, you know, clearly that has told Canada that it needs to retaliate almost irrespective of the economic cost. What does it tell the rest of the world? Well, it clearly tells the rest of the world that what's the point of having a trade deal with the United States when the president is Donald Trump? As Mark Carney, you know, eloquently put it, sometimes the signature of the United States is written in pencil, right? Trump just changes it when he feels like it. Other countries have felt the same, Korea, the UK, obviously the EU. So what it shows is that if you get into a situation of economic or, for that matter, national security dependency on the United States, which many countries in Europe, Asia, and elsewhere have, that, from the Donald Trump's point of view, is a source of leverage. It's a source of extraction. And it is certainly, I think, that being the general agenda that is being pursued vis-a-vis Canada. But also, we saw that last year during the Turnberry agreement negotiations with Europe. We've certainly seen it vis-a-vis key allies in Asia. I mean, it's no secret that South Korea is now contemplating sending naval ships to help the U.S. Navy in the Strait of Hormuz. Why is that? Well, it has obviously a lot to do with the demands of the Trump administration for help on that theater as well. So it basically underlines that even the closest and historically longest lasting economic and political relationships do not mean anything to Donald Trump. And that is a very powerful signal to the rest of the world.
Phil, you worked in the Biden administration in the State Department. You've been watching the international trade field for much longer than that. How unusual is it for a trade dispute like this to also get caught up in things like trying to rename Lake Ontario? I'm particularly stuck on the lake because apparently there's a canal that a whole lot of business goes through that Canada could potentially close to U.S. ships if things continue to escalate. Like, this seems like a really cross-cutting sort of dispute to me, but how do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, well, I can't remember another time when names of lakes came into play. But I guess, I mean, there's a few things I would say here. The first is, look, before joining the Biden administration in the State Department, you know, I was an academic economist. So I was thinking about these things largely through the lens of, you know, at least borderline rationality and, you know, rational actors. When you get into government, you realize, oh, man, like, that's not how this works at all. You know, people's emotions really do play an important role in these things. And I think that, you know, I think this administration, while it understands the importance of emotions in domestic politics, I think it really underestimates or misplays the role of emotions internationally. I think, you know, we've heard this from a lot of diplomats here in D.C., and we've tried to explain this to the administration a lot of times. When you play on this turf, when you make things really emotional, whether it's the 51st state or the all these different, naming different things America, you create an immense amount of bad will politically, and especially when you're dealing with democracies or any population or any country that sort of has to respond to their populaces, you shrink the space for your partners to give you what you want, right? To the point made earlier, Mark Carney is doing great right now, right? He's doing great by standing up to us. The worst thing he could do politically right now would be seen to be giving in to the Americans. Canada is probably the most extreme example of that, but there are certainly things that maybe European politicians would be consider doing, but can't because of the, you know, the enmity, the opinion towards America right now. you're even seeing that in Mexico, where, again, the Venezuela comparison is being made. So I think this is not the way you normally want to do things, obviously. It certainly is the case that rhetoric can very easily bleed into decision making. But I think this administration is uniquely able to sort of continue to poke at things in ways that, again, I don't think serve their long-term interests in any real way. And it's not just at the political level, too. I mean, I think the American people are paying a larger cost because of this, right? So, I have some research and others have as well, looking at sort of the amount of cross-border trade happening between Canada and the United States, right? The number of Canadians that have crossed the border gone down by about a quarter, the biggest drop in any crossings, basically minus COVID, essentially, this is billions of dollars. And that's not only, that's to the states that have these competitive races. It's Maine, it's New Hampshire, it's Washington, it's Michigan. So, I think this rhetoric, to your point, not normal and I don't think helpful either, right? It's part of the problem here too is, look, USTR, you may not like their position, but USTR largely is trying to engage in relatively normal trade negotiation, right? They're putting out positions to the degree to which they're allowed to. They're sort of, sticking to them. But you're trying to do that at the same time you're having these sort of more emotional battles of will. And that just makes the actual art of finding compromise all the more difficult.
Jacob, do you think the Welland Canal could be a sticking point?
No, I think very clearly. I mean, I think we will have to see. First, will there be a deal before the actual Canadian retaliation comes into play? Then, as Ignacio mentioned, the Trump administration has already said that, if that happens, another round of escalation comes by year end. That's after the midterms. A lot of things might change by then. But if you see further escalation, basically beyond the straight up tariff categories into other means of engagement, economic transactions, could be the canal. Obviously, Ontario Premier Doug Ford has mentioned, well, we're going to stop exporting electricity to the U.S. There is, of course, also the possibility of export taxes on Canadian crude oil exports. There are many things you could imagine if it gets into a further escalatory cycle. And certainly that canal would also be an obvious pressure point for the Canadians to use.
Ignacio?
Yeah, well, actually, I may be a little bit more optimistic about, after some turbulence, this trade war to come into a point of stability. And let me explain why. One thing which I found very interesting is the huge shift of narrative in only 2 days. Both sides were basically saying on Wednesday, we're almost there to get a deal done. And then we come to Friday and we have a big trade war. All the indications is that the real thing that broke the discussions was the insistence by Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, that he was not ready to bring down the tariffs on the Canadian trucks. And this is a hugely important business. It is something that Canada and Mexico were the only countries in the world that were not paying a 25% tariff before 2025. And then the Trump administration find an excuse to apply a 25% tariff also to them, which is hugely disruptive for the Canadian companies, particularly in Ontario. And it's very clear that on the thing that really has had a big impact on the United States and which probably has also impacted psychologically President Trump, which is actually the fact that American alcohol cannot be sold in the shops, particularly in Ontario. There's no way that Doug Ford is going to actually move unless the United States brings down the tariff on cars. So I somehow think that after a lot of noise, after the midterms, some way to find a fix on the core economic issue, which is this issue about trucks and booze, if you want. I still think that the deal is doable. And quite frankly, every conflict has a silver lining. I mean, no one really knows exactly what the United States asked Canadian to do in terms of its negotiation with their countries. There has been a lot of lack of clarity about that. But this issue has become now politically so visible, so much related to the sovereignty of Canada, that I cannot see Canada agreeing on anything that looks in any way as compromised is right to negotiate trade agreement with their countries. And I think that's very good news because, quite frankly, we have also been hearing noises about the Fortress America, about something that could eventually come out of the USMCA renegotiation. And I see that, in my view, becomes more unlikely after you have had this spat between Canada and the United States on these issues relating to sovereignty. Which is not to say that there might not be some areas where Canada may decide to align with the United States. I mean, the obvious one would be a steel. And quite frankly, who is going to criticize Canada for that after what the European Union has done on a steel? So it might be that at some point in time, Mark Carney decides, yes, we are going to increase our external steel tariff as the Europeans have done. But this would have to be seen as being a sovereign decision by Canada and not as something which is somehow being imposed by the big brother down to the border. So I still, if you want me to put my money on the table, then, you know, I still think that it's more likely than not that we don't really see the 50% tariff on cars that have been threatened by President Trump, and that sometime after the midterms, some form of agreement is reached on the core economic issues. And then other issues would be further discussed as part of the USMCA process of negotiations that would probably take quite some time. So that would be my own personal prediction.
Thank you so much. I should say we're recording this on Friday, September the 4th. So if you're listening to this podcast after that, something may have happened. This is a very fast-moving and uncertain situation. In the next part of our podcast, I want to take it over to Europe and its relationships with both the U.S. and with Canada now and also in previous iterations of trade negotiations. Ignacio, walk us through some of the highlights. There's been a lot happening in the last decade.
Well, obviously, we have a very good comprehensive trade agreement with Canada, CETA, which, as Krista Freeland sometimes thinks, likes to say, in certain areas goes farther than the USMCA. For instance, we have a reciprocal opening of our procurement markets, which Canada does not have with the United States anymore, since Canada decided not to maintain procurement within the USMCA. So this is a very solid trade agreement with Canada. I'm sure that in the current geopolitical context, and Mark Carney coming to Europe at the time of the State of the Union speech by President von der Leyen, I'm sure there's going to be interest of doing more with Canada. I mean, there are already ongoing negotiations on digital. So I think that the conclusion of a digital trade agreement between Canada and the European Union seems to be quite close. I don't know where it will already be announced at the time of Carney's visit. I think that there is going to be clearly a lot of interest of working more with Canada on economic security matters, and including, of course, on critical raw materials. I think probably the European Union may be able to have a little bit more of fuss with Canada on those issues than with the United States. I'm sure that's something which is going to be explored. There's also this very interesting concept launched by Canada of a coalition in support of rule-based trade. And there have been discussions between the European Union and the CPTPP, not for the European Union to join the CPTPP, but to see whether you could actually work on some rules areas together with the CPTPP. And I think that the fact that Mark Carney is here may perhaps also inspire Ursula von der Leyen to talk a little bit more about these issues in her State of the Union address. I think that would be very good if the European Union was ready to invest a little bit more politically on this idea of a coalition of countries in support of rule-based trade. So that's on the Canadian front. Well, on the United States, you know, once in a long time ago, we tried to negotiate a comprehensive trade agreement with the United States. I used to be the chief negotiator for that, the TTIP. Sometimes people come to me and say, well, what a pity that you didn't succeed. You would not have gone through all of this agitation. I say, well, I'm sorry, but I think the United States would have elected President Trump regardless of what we have done on TTIP. And I think that President Trump would have ignored TTIP the same way that he has ignored all the other trade agreements that have been negotiated by the United States. Now we have, of course, this temporary agreement, which, of course, is very imperfect. It is very asymmetrical. I feel, and by the way, it has a sell-by date, because I think one thing that was quite interesting in the discussion that took place between the Commission, Council and the European Parliament is that the European Parliament insisted that this asymmetrical tariff deal could only last until the end of 2029, and at that point in time it would expire, which implies that one should start to be thinking about if there's a political change in the United States, what kind of agreement could we place standard? One thing that probably a lot of people are thinking about, would the European Union have been able to obtain a better deal if it had retaliated as Canada did? Well, let me be very honest on this. When it comes to the treatment of steel, aluminium, and cars, the three sectors which are at the heart of the conflict now between Canada and the United States, I don't think we're frankly having retaliated at this point in time. We have got us any better deal under Thunberry than we decided not to retaliate. I think the current situation is very different to the one that we have in Trump 1. In Trump 1, both Canada and the European Union retaliated. The result of that is that we managed to avoid Section 232 tariffs on cars. And Canada, but not the European Union, managed to get out of the tariffs on steel. I think at this point in time, this administration sees retaliation almost as a personal insult. And I would doubt very much that having retaliated before the Thunberry Agreement would have resulted in a better deal on the steel and aluminium sector or on the car sector. Now, this is controversial. Some people may think differently. Now, a totally different question is how should the European Union react if there were going to be demands coming from the United States that threatened the European Union sovereignty in a similar manner to the demands that apparently were put on Canada. And there I have no hesitation. The European Union should say, no, we are not ready to negotiate on those issues. And you are going to be applying tariffs on us because of that, we will counter retaliate. Now, that was not the Thunberry Agreement. I don't think there were concessions in Thunberry that put into question European Union sovereignty, but we all know that these things might happen. Is this a speculation of what happens after there's some kind of truce with Canada, with the attention turned then to the European Union, with all these very bellicose statements by President Trump on digital regulations? So we may think things happening. And I think that in my view, the inspiration by Mark Carney, by Canada, say certainly we are not ready to negotiate and we rather to face tariffs and retaliate rather than to reach an agreement that put in question our sovereignty. I really hope that that will also be the attitude of the European Union, and I think it will.
So what's your take on transatlantic trade?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, Canada obviously is going to be thinking about and is thinking about sort of diversifying its trade relationships. You know, obviously, it's incredibly integrated with the United States. It will remain, I would assume, very integrated with the United States. But it's realizing just how much that, you know, if that asymmetry in dependency is weaponized as it is now, that puts you in a really tough spot, right? I think all of us are now realizing just how much asymmetries can matter. If we move away from a rules-based system. I think people in the States, I think this administration, are sort of assuming Canada doesn't have another option in some sense. And I think that's a little bit short-sighted. I mean, obviously, I hope and I predict that we'll be able to, after some amount of time lapses, we'll be able to go back to a more normal relationship. But, you know, there are other Arctic Circle, you know, nations with long borders with partners that they basically shut off. I mean, you know, Finland is not exactly, a trading relationship with Russia. You know, you can move away, like at high cost, but you can move away from partners if things get really bad. And one thing I would note here again is, you know, look, we have the fact that we're using, you know, 232 national security tariffs against Canada is fairly remarkable because we have a joint military command, right? We have NORAD. Like this is it is about as close a relationship as you can have. And for that reason. So I expect Canada to diversify, increase its ties with Europe. Another thing I would say, and this is, you know, this one way in which Europe and Canada kind of have another solution to their problem in common, which is deepening the integrated market. Canada is about as loose a federation as you can have. You and Canada and the European Union giving each other runs for the money in that sense. To the point about the sort of alcohol bans, those are provincial decisions, right? The provinces have an enormous amount of sway over their trade relations. relationships. So that's one thing I think that Canada is thinking about as well in terms of deepening their relationships. You know, I am very hopeful that there is sort of this, you know, coalition of countries that are dedicated to keeping the rules-based system intact, you know, a coalition of middle powers, as sort of Carney puts it. It is going to be remarkably difficult, though, because if it would be slightly easier if it was just the United States sort of throwing sticks in the spokes, so to speak. But we also have China here, which is both an economic challenge and a potentially economic security challenge. And so the rules-based system, you know, as much as I want it to be enough, the old system is going to need to be refined. We're going to need to have better tools to deal with things like overcapacity or excess dependencies. So, you know, it's not as much as just holding up the old house. That also has to evolve. And I think there's where, you know, Canada can work more closely with Europe and others, right? This is where one of the reasons I'm so frustrated by the policies of my administration is it's not as though we're just sort of, you know, picking away at a system that's working. We're picking it away at a system. At the same time, we really have to be helping build a new one, right? We have a coalition of countries who sort of understand the problem, at least some of the problem together, and we're missing the opportunity now to sort of create that new system going forward. So hopefully Canada can lead and we'll catch up at some point.
Jacob, Phil made a great point about the single market. And in Europe, there's been a sense that if this Trump administration can't push Europe to finish the single market, what will? What do you think is going on here? And why is Europe finding it so hard to unite its biggest strength, which is this huge integrated economic area?
Well, I mean, that is just national special interest. I mean, we've been trying to complete the internal market ever since it was created, if you like, in the early 1990s. That it's fundamentally special interest groups, German accountants, French lawyers, etc. And, you know, the Cold War wasn't enough. The emergence of China as a strategic across the entire manufacturing sector, tech spectrum hasn't been enough. And I don't think, for better or for worse, that the emergence of a rogue U.S. president is going to do it. This is just one of these things, unfortunately. Certainly, the Draghi report hasn't moved the needle either on that issue. It's just embedded, unfortunately, I think, in Europe's political and therefore institutional architecture that there are clear limits to how integrated our economies can make. And I think the point that Philip just made, that in some ways, Donald Trump's bullying behavior has been a gift to Mark Carney. Because if you look at what Mark Carney has done in terms of fossil fuel pipelines and other things that his liberal predecessor were, you know, maybe by choice, but certainly also pushed to largely abandon. He has, pointing to the obvious threat from the Trump administration in terms of economic coercion, you know, building up Canada by overcoming many of these provincial trade barriers. But what it tells you is that even in a federal state like Canada, overcoming these types of barriers requires, you know, truly extraordinary politics. And it may sound weird, but, you know, even the Trump administration, for all the revolutions that it has caused and so many other levels, overcoming internal trade barriers in the EU, even Donald Trump can do that. He can make us, and he can succeed in making the EU sign a lot of new trade agreements. We saw EU-Japan in the first Trump administration. I certainly don't think that EU-India or EU-Mercosur or even the Indonesia deal would have been struck without the Trump factor being a part. But the hardest nuts to crack are these deeply entrenched domestic special interest groups in especially the large member states, but let's be honest, every member has them. And therefore, unfortunately, you know, even Donald Trump isn't going to be able to force through things like the Draghi agenda and the associated deepening of the internal market.
Ignacio, when the EU and Canada were negotiating, my memory is that provincial politics were a big sticking point in getting the thing finally done. And that even after the deal was signed, there was still considerable time spent negotiating provincial dairy quotas and other things like that to really get it finished. How do you see it?
Well, you know, I mean, luckily, after going through that terrible experience on CETA Bologna, the European Union managed to get its act together that all the trade agreements that we now conclude are EU-only agreements that do not require unanimity by the member states. I think that was, every crisis creates opportunities. And as a result of that, we clarified the competences with the European Court of Justice and Mercosur, India, Indonesia, all of these trade agreements are basically EU only. But of course, Canada, the provinces had a lot of power. And I think I'm sure that the role of Doug Ford has been perhaps as important as the role of Mark Carney in explaining why things have evolved the way that have evolved. After all, it is really sale of American alcohol into Ontario and exports of cars produced in Ontario to the United States, which are at the core of this dispute. But what is really remarkable is I was actually in Canada 1 year ago and I was talking with a group of Canadians about all of these talks about eliminating barriers to intra-provincial trade, how serious this is. And people were extremely skeptical. They say, well, we have been talking about that for the last 40 years. It's never going to happen. It seems to be happening, no? But so I think that the push what the United States is threatening and doing to Canada is a much bigger economic threat than what the U.S. has been doing to the European Union. But perhaps the combination of the U.S. threat with the China threat can't help the European Union to get its act together, if not on a whole single market agenda, at least in terms of having a more robust trade policy and particularly working with other like-minded countries in terms of this idea about how to reinforce rule-based trade. I think this is a politically very powerful idea, and I really hope, as I said before, that coming from this visit of Mark Carney to Europe, this is really taken up again by Ursula von der Leyen, and it's finally taken to concrete actions to work with closer trading partners on economic security, to work with the CPTPP on issues like the inter-trade, like supply chain resilience. Because at this point in time, you really need to have a little bit of capacity to push and lead among different kinds of configuration that would not include the United States at this point in time, that would not include China. And I think that's, in my view, what really needs to happen over the next 2 years.
Thanks for that. And of course, the comprehensive and progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership. And on the day when I get that right, I will have graduated into trade nirvana.
Everyone name. Let's call it, let's just call it the way it used to be called before Justin Trudeau decided that he wanted to give to this agreement a more modern name. Let's just call it the TPP. But actually, no, they need to give it a new name because it's no longer about the Pacific. The UK is there. Costa Rica is going to be there. I think they need to be finding a new name for that plurilateral agreement. But this is basically a comprehensive plurilateral trade agreement that includes key countries in the Indo-Pacific, but also a number of Latin American countries. It has Canada, it has Mexico, it has Chile, and also now the United Kingdom. And there's the new idea that the European Union and the CPTPP to be working together in terms of potentially developing trade agreements between the EU on the one side and the CPTPP on the other.
Great points, all of it. We're coming to the end of our time, but Jacob, I do want to come back to you on where we're going next with this. And I keep coming back to, what does this mean for the world when two such close allies are having such an intense economic dispute?
Look, I mean, I think it shows to some extent, look, what almost happened between the EU and the UK after Brexit, right? That actually, I mean, Ignacio, I think, mentioned, or maybe it was Philip who mentioned Finland, that you can actually, politics is ultimately in the driving seat and will dictate economics if the stakes are high enough. I will also say that I think, and I probably share some of Ignacio's optimism, that at the end of the day, especially once the light, in my opinion, likely political impact of this trade war coming right before the midterms are factored in, I think a solution will be found that will avoid it. But we are, you know, awfully close with maybe 1 foot, you know, into the abyss where politics really trumps, you know, no pun intended, the underlying beneficial economic integration, even among the, you know, traditional political value and other allies. And I think in some ways that is the most concerning element of this, that it can actually, we can actually get to that point because, as Philip also mentioned, emotions actually do play a role also at the international state. It isn't all about interests, because if this was all about economic interests, well, then this would not obviously be happening. So it does illustrate, I think, how we're heading into, or have been for some time, I guess, in a more irrational world. At the global trading system, can, as Mark Carney said, a coalition of like-minded middle powers push back against that? Well, hopefully. And I certainly think that the EU-Canada relationship, because it now also involves a fairly explicit military and security component, where Canada is a part of the European Safe Rearmament Program, it has that component to it. I think that they will have to show, Carney and von der Leyen and other EU leaders will have to show that they can walk the walk and not just talk the talk, hopefully starting later when Mark Carney, as Ignacio mentioned, comes to Brussels.
Thank you. Philip, closing thoughts?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I share the optimism that hopefully we can get through this and you know, cooler heads can prevail. Because, you know, as Ignacio mentioned earlier, yes, this is not, it's not the hugest economic escalation at this point. $20 billion on either side, national level, not a huge thing. There are relatively small sticking points, I think, that really, I think if we can get there, we can kind of unwind this again, if we can sort of let rationality sort of win the day. That said, of course, I think this is going to have an impact on the midterms if nothing happens between now and November. Because while nationally this isn't a huge deal, there's a lot of seafood in the Canadian retaliation. It's honestly about almost like 40% of Maine's total trade with Canada. So, and you know, northern New Hampshire is a relatively lower income part of the nation. Lots of integration with Canada. That Senate race is getting more difficult. Same thing with Michigan. So I think the Trump administration, I would guess, is already getting quite a bit of pressure from Senate and Congress candidates and current members to resolve this, or at least find a way, an off-ramp to some degree. So I'm hoping we can find that. I don't know that that's going to be enough to sort of change the eventual outcome. So I think, you know, Carney's bet in some sense here is let's see how the politics change a bit going forward. Now, again, I think we can get out of this this particular issue, but I don't expect a huge change in attitude or behavior from the Trump administration over the next few years. I mean, there's plenty of other investigations ongoing, whether they be national security, 232 tariffs, or 301, you know, discrimination tariffs. You know, I assume we'll have something on digital trade with many of our partners going forward. And we're still waiting on semiconductors and pharma and everything else. So, you know, and then once you get out of this administration, then the hard work of unwinding all this is going to take place. And I'd love Ignacio's thought on this, but I've never seen a trade negotiator who wants to unilaterally get rid of leverage. So, you know, it's not like they're just all going to go away. So I think we're going to have to find a way to get off of this path at some point. But, you know, over the next few months here, it'll be an interesting thing to watch.
Ignacio?
Well, I could not really improve on what Philip had just said. I think we're going to have turbulence with the Trump administration all the way down to the end. By the way, Philip has not mentioned the overcapacity fill one. We'll be here to make them out any of these days. So yeah, it's going to be a lot of things to comment around on trade. And I think it's going to require also some real good thinking transatlantically about how to prepare for the future relationship with the future administration. Because I said, the Tambury Agreement was concluded under certain circumstances. It has a sell-by date. I think one should really start thinking what is politically feasible that could come after that.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. We've been joined today by Philip Luck from the Center for Strategic International Studies, as well as Bruegel's Ignacio Garcia Becerro and Jacob Funk Kierkegaard. I'm really grateful to all three of you for joining us today. We will link to your reports and research in our show notes. Everything will be available for free on our website, bruegel.org, along with the archives of this podcast. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.